Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Before she was placed on the enemy's list of Saddam Hussein, which is a very dangerous place to have been, the poet Dunya Mikhail worked as a journalist for the Baghdad Observer. As the threats against her and many other journalists grew, Mikhail eventually decided to leave Iraq and came to the United States in 1996. She now teaches Arabic at Oakland University in Michigan. Mikhail writes in Arabic, English, and Aramaic, and she's written about war and its aftermath in a number of poetry collections.
Yesterday, I lost a country. I was in a hurry and didn't notice when it fell from me like a broken branch from a forgetful tree. Please, if anyone passes by and stumbles across it, perhaps in a suitcase...
Her new book, The Beekeeper, is a return to journalism. It tells of dozens of Yazidi women who survived kidnapping and sexual slavery by the Islamic State, which she calls by the Arabic term Daesh, and the man, a beekeeper, who helped arrange their escapes. Dunya Mikhail spoke with The New Yorker's executive editor and the host of our podcast, The Political Scene, Dorothy Wickenden.
The stories in the book come to you primarily through one man, a beekeeper named Abdullah, who has dedicated himself to helping Yazidi women escape from captivity. Tell me about him. What kind of man undertakes this kind of work, and how did you get to know him?
Yes, actually, I knew him by chance. I was trying to talk to some of these women to understand what's going on. I mean, I was just... couldn't comprehend that this could happen in this time and you know, our time.
And you're in Michigan at this point.
Yes. So I was calling friends to, you know, just wondering what on earth is going on. Is that true? Is this not coming from fairy tales or something? But they were confirming this is what's happening. Everybody telling me what's happening to people they know. And I called even, you know, relatives. Anyways, but I tried to talk to some of these women who made it back. They escaped. And by chance, one of the calls, Abdullah answered the phone. And sometimes, you know, people in Sinjar, they don't know Arabic, so they answer in Kurdish language, so I couldn't understand. But Abdullah spoke in Arabic. So he said the person I was asking to talk to, her name was Nadia, was his cousin. But then she spoke in Kurdish, so he translated between us. When he translated between us and she was saying that Abdullah rescued her, I said, who is Abdullah? And she said, this is the man who's translating. Talking more and more with him, I learned that he was a beekeeper, that he left his bees and farm and everything there in Sinjar. And it all started on personal level. He was trying to find his own sister and his niece. And then even though he didn't find his niece, he was not feeling bad that he was just rescuing, you know, strangers. He was so positive. I liked how his behavior was. He told me, every time I save someone, I save my sister.
And I weep, he says. He tries to be there when they're reunited with his family. And
exactly.
He said each time, 70 times, he says he's gone through this.
Yes, but 70 times then. Now is over 350 times.
Hello.
مرحبا.
Hello, مرحبا. إني شلونك؟
أنا الحمد لله شلونك أنت؟
الله يخليك ربي يحفظك.
أكو صورة هاد زيت إياها اللي بيها.
Okay, could you tell us a little bit about what that conversation was about?
So he sometimes would send me his picture without explanation.
Yes.
So I would get back.
Many of which are in the book.
Yes.
Yes.
So I asked. So he said, "This is Parveen." He said, do you remember Nadia? I said, yeah. And he said, okay, so when Nadia came, she told everyone that she saw that in the same place, house, there was a woman who couldn't talk or hear. And then everybody heard that. So her brother said, this must be my sister, Parveen.
So how does a typical rescue mission work? How does Abdullah, I remember at one point he describes his rescue operations as similar to his work as a beekeeper, and he talked about his hive. So how did he go about that?
Yes, that was so metaphorical for me mm-hmm. when he mentioned it, how you need to be organized, you need to be careful, you need to do the plans step by step. Usually it starts with a call from the person, usually the woman. she calls somebody in her village, a relative.
And they're calling from the house where they are being held captive?
No. So each story is different. So, for example, some of them would find the nearest, if they see an internet cafe, where they ask to use the phone. And sometimes, you know, they, of course, they don't have money, so they would ask if that's possible to do that. So now some of them, just in the street, a man is coming or a woman is coming and they say, can we use the phone? And that, in those places, you don't know who is the friend, who's the enemy. It's so risky to do anything, to ask a person something. It's very risky. Yet, I mean, they did it. So then that person would call Abdullah, or maybe there are others like Abdullah. He would tell them, please don't tell them how are you and all that. Just take their, where are they? That's what we need to know. Just don't. So, and then he uses his, you know, his knowledge of the area that he knows, and he uses the Google map.
And he calls smugglers.
Then he called the smugglers, and they make a plan. The smugglers who used to smuggle cigarettes before, now they switch to, instead of cigarettes, and the same places that where they were storing the cigarettes, they bring women and have them stay there for a day or two. So there was an office that was opened after this Daesh invasion. There's an office of kidnapped affairs. This was opened in response to, for example, people like Abdullah, who are doing it on personal level. So they wanted to kind of try to help. Sometimes they need to finance the smugglers and all their expenses and everything. Now this office, they don't compensate right away. They wait until the person comes, the woman, let's say, and her children. After they arrive and give their testimony and their statement, then they're going to compensate whoever they borrowed the money from. But then Abdullah was saying, we can't wait. This is like urgent work. So they're still doing it their own way without waiting. And then later, he said, okay, compensation comes later. We're not going to wait for this.
And how does Abdullah make his living now?
So as a beekeeper, he was selling honey between Iraq and Syria. And that's how he was able to know those people in Syria that helped him in the first place, the merchants. And because this a trade in our area is done, is actually done different way than here. It's all done by loans.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe here it's more formal level, like credit. They don't have those types of banks and credit. They don't deal with that. It's all personal level. They trust this person. They would give the material later.
The two countries.
Yes, mm-hmm. Even between the two countries. Because of his reputation and the trust he built throughout the years with selling honey, that's how this helped him in this work, that trust that even with the rescuing of women, it's okay, you don't have money this moment, you're going to give us tomorrow.
The subtitle of your book, The Beekeeper, is Rescuing the Stolen Women of Iraq. And ISIS, or Daesh, as you call the jihadi group, has perpetrated so many atrocities in recent years that I wanted to ask you to explain its attacks on Yazidis in Sinjar. Why were they singled out for especially savage treatment in what became a genocide?
Yes. Well, first, when they attacked the area, all the non-Muslims, they call them non-believers. They labeled houses with the letter N for Nasara we can say non-believers. And first it was them. But then the Christians, or who they call them Nasara, were they were allowed to leave, even though empty-handed, because they call them people of the book, because they have the Bible. The Yazidis, they don't have a religious book, so to them they are infidels. So they thought that they could do whatever they want they wanted with them. So actually they killed men. They even buried some older women alive. They took younger women as female slaves or sex slaves, and their children also. They kind of they even They had them for service, and older boys, they had them for in the training camps. So they to them, this is spoils of war.
So the Iran-Iraq War began in the fall of 1980, and it triggered really most of the regional conflicts that we've all witnessed since then. You left in 1995. What did it feel like to watch the Iraq War and its aftermath starting in 2003 from the United States?
You know, it's sometimes it's. I mean, when this it looks like the war is as I mentioned, it's growing with us. It grew with us. It survived with us. I mean, even after I left from afar, I still as if it's still there. And I don't know. I feel like when I make these contacts with my friends back home. The war is so familiar that it is kind of ignored. I mean, it's so familiar. It's expected. It's part of life. It became part of life. Like a friend said, a bullet hit her shoulder, and she didn't care. She said, but it was by accident. It happened as if she was saying, today, by the way, I watched this or I read this, this bullet. I was just passing and came, I don't know from where. So it's like as if it's part of everyday life and people ignore it and laugh. I don't know.
Over the last year, Daesh has been effectively driven out of Iraq, but thousands of Yazidi women and children are still unaccounted for. Some are in captivity, some are dead. I think it's been 2 years since you visited Abdullah. So he assured you that the publication of the book wouldn't cause harm to him. But is that true? And also, how has he managed to avoid detection? How did he manage to avoid detection all of those years by Daesh?
Yeah, I mean, I was concerned about that. And he actually, he said, no, not only no, he said, I wish this be translated to other languages. I want as many people as possible to know what happened to us. Actually, he said his dream that this becomes a movie.
Well, and Abdullah is right, even though he didn't put it this way. This book is a story of heroism on so many parts, his obviously among them. I've got a book of your poems here, The War Works Hard. And you wrote those poems, as I understand, between 1985 and 2004. And I want to end by having you read, I think it's the first poem in this book. It's called Bag of Bones.
Yes, Bag of Bones. What good luck, she has found his bones. The skull is also in the bag in her hand, like all other bags in all other trembling hands. His bones, like thousands of bones in the mass graveyard. His skull, not like any other skull. Two eyes or holes with which he saw too much. Two ears with which he listened to music that told his own story. A nose that never knew clean air. A mouth open like a chasm. Was not like that when he kissed her, there, quietly, not in this place, noisy with skulls and bones and dust. Dug up with questions. What does it mean to die all this death in a place where the darkness plays all this silence? What does it mean to meet your loved ones now with all of these hollow places? To give back to your mother on the occasion of death a handful of bones she had given to you on the occasion of birth? To depart without death or birth certificates? Because the dictator does not give receipts when he takes your life. The dictator has a skull too, a huge one, not like any other skull. It solved by itself a math problem that multiplied the one death by millions to equal homeland. The dictator is the director of a great tragedy. He has an audience too, an audience that claps until the bones begin to rattle, the bones in the bags, the full bag finally in her hand, unlike her disappointed neighbor, who has not yet found her own.
The poet Dunya Mikhail speaking with The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden. Mikhail's new book is The Beekeeper.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.